Since 2011, the Butte Civil Public Archives has worked with the ethnic communities in Butte and created an exhibit for each dedicated to their heritage. In 2019, the Butte Civil Public Archives and the Montana Preservation Alliance received a National Endowment for the Humanities Common Heritage Grant to continue this work on Butte's unrepresented communities, the Jewish, Finnish, German, and Hispanics of Butte. The archives held two-day events where they invited speakers, collected stories and artifacts from each of the ethnic communities, and hosted an exhibit. This project culminates in a four-part radio series funded by the Greater Montana Foundation to share the stories of the people who contributed to Butte's melting pot. This is the story of Butte's Jewish community, produced with the congregation of B'nai Israel Synagogue. We'll explore the culture, religion, and impact of the Jewish on Butte's community. Over the decades, the Jewish population of Butte has dwindled, but the B'nai Israel congregation proudly keeps their traditions alive, holding worship services regularly and celebrating high holy days and life events for all members of the community. Jewish settlers were among the many pioneers drawn to territorial Montana during the 19th century. Like other early day immigrants, many came west from the old world, seeking a better life in America. Bonnie Canty shares this touching anecdote about her father-in-law, Avern Canty's immigration story, and the impact seeing the Statue of Liberty for the first time had on him.
Many years ago, we were doing, when it was some anniversary of the Statue of Liberty, and I can't remember which one, but Avern was at our house. It was the 4th of July, and he was glued to the TV. You had to serve him dinner in front of the TV. He did not move because they were doing that big thing about the Statue of Liberty. He vividly remembered coming on the boat to see her. I know. And how he felt with his mother seeing that. We went out to my folks' house in Waterville and do it. That was the big fireworks show and stuff. He would not leave. He got in the house, he sat down, we turned on the TV, he stayed there. He saw no fireworks.
Montana's Jewish pioneers mostly came from eastern states, German cities, and modest villages in Prussia, Bavaria, Austria, and Poland. To stake their futures in the mining camps of Bannock, Helena, and Virginia City, where the territory's first Hebrew Benevolent Society was established in 1865. Transplanted into the mining West, these early settlers assimilated readily into the ethnic fabric of Butte, drawing from their educational roots and business networks to build a community of merchants, attorneys, and financiers, as well as miners, tailors, and jewelers. There were many Jewish businesses in Uptown Butte, and tea houses became popular on Butte's east side, where a cup of coffee or a tumbler of tea could be had, along with hearty Jewish cuisine and pastries, including German coffee cake, French brioche, and the Jewish specialty cheese or blackberry blintzers. The first Jewish settlers are first documented in Butte in 1875. At the height of immigration and growth in the mining city, the 1900 Butte census numbered over 233 Jewish working adults, suggesting a population close to 1,000 people of all ages. One of the founding members of the community was Henry Jacobs, a prominent merchant who served as Butte's first mayor from 1879 to 1880. Aaron Rosen, professor of religious studies and director of international and cultural projects at Rocky Mountain College in Billings, has this to say about Jewish immigrants to America.
Jews in Montana, as many of you know already, sometimes were coming from Minneapolis, and a lot of them were coming backwards from California following the direction of mining. So after the gold rush tapers there, and then they're making their way to places like Colorado and up to Montana, and then within Montana, so we go into the more granular detail, of course, as we've already talked about today, that places like Helena and then Virginia City were places with great mining activity. And then you had Jews who would go to places like Missoula, as we talked about, I think it was the 1870s you were mentioning, and then a few would come to Billings, but Billings was slow to develop. So largely what we see then is we see this move, diversifying and spreading out, a kind of dispersion from this Helena area And you see Jewish presence here, certainly by the 1870s. And you have to the point where some of the very first citizens that are listed in Butte are Jews. And of course, as we know, the first mayor and then another Jewish mayor, Lupin Frank. Yeah, so it's real. And that is really competitive with a lot of more cosmopolitan places in America. I think it's around the same time that there's a Jewish mayor in San Francisco.
Since Butte's earliest days, the Jewish community has been an integral part of the city. Although a majority of Jews were self-employed in a variety of professions, there were several Jewish men who worked in Butte's copper mines. One man, Leo Morris, was killed in the Granite Mountain mine fire in 1917. Jews on the West had many challenges in practicing their faith. Kosher foods were difficult to obtain. There were language barriers that many of Butte's immigrants had to deal with. But the community helped one another to learn English. Described by Linda Bookie.
So the Rayfish brothers and the Gronfines immigrated together, and our families go back that far. My parents still see the remaining Gronfine grandkids, great-grandkids, whatever. And the Rudolph family of Rudolph's, you know, Pam and Mike came later, and Lou Rudolph told me once that my great-grandmother, Leah, for whom I'm named, taught his mother Bess how to speak English. She only spoke Yiddish.
It was a challenge to keep their shops opened on the Sabbath, given that miners were usually off on Saturday, making it the busiest shopping day. Even though they faced challenges with the practices of their religion, they remained faithful. As a second generation of Jews settled into Butte, the community became static and then declined. The grandchildren of Jewish pioneers were encouraged to move to cities with more active Jewish cultural centers. And by the 1970s, there were fewer than 40 Jewish families in Butte. Today, the number of Jewish residents has dwindled in the mining city, but those who remain are joined by their faith and the culture resilience of a strong and close-knit people who are proud of their heritage. One of these people is Glenn Rayfish, who's trying to keep his family's Butte roots alive.
So I was born and raised here, and my father had Newman's Brewery. It operated for 50 years. It was a family shoe store. And I was fortunate enough to work with my dad for 18 of those 50 years. So my brother at that time also worked with us, and he opened up his own travel agency. I'm kind of the last Rayfish, actually trying to maintain our Jewish heritage here because of the long history of our family being here.
The origins of Judaism in Butte trace back to the establishment of the city's Hebrew Benevolent Association in 1881. The first Jewish service was held in Butte in 1892. They were Orthodox but incorporated some of the practices of the Reform movement. Congregation B'nai Israel formed in 1901, and the following year the Jewish community split into Orthodox and Reformed congregations, each with their own rabbi and place of worship. The Orthodox group organized a Adath Israel congregation in 1901 with about 75 members who met in the former Norwegian Lutheran Church. In 1916, a new temple was built near Emma Park, which served the congregation until mining subsidence damaged the building, after which the congregation met in a home on West Park Street. A second Orthodox group, the Montefiore Congregation, met at the Knights of Pythias Hall, led by Rabbi Ehrlich. The Reform group, what would become B'nai Israel, held their first services in the Carpenters Union Hall on West Granite Street in 1892. The group moved into the Mountain View Methodist Church. The Reform group sought to assimilate more with the community, as Linda Bookie describes here.
Reform Judaism, especially sort of classical Reform, really was all about assimilation and becoming more, you know, more assimilated into American tradition. And girls in traditional religion never had bat mitzvahs. Boys had bar mitzvahs, but girls did not read from the Torah. And so even when I was growing up, I was given the choice to have a bat mitzvah and decided not to. My brother did not have that same choice. And so confirmation was something that served as a substitute. It was more common for girls than boys, but to confirm their faith, and they did that at 10th grade.
In 1903, Rabbi Harry Weiss took charge of the B'nai Israel congregation and made plans to build Butte's first synagogue on February 26, 1904. B'nai Israel was dedicated, and addresses were made by ex-Senator Lee Mantle and Rabbi Weiss, was quoted as saying, "It was not money, nor bricks, nor mortar that made this edifice, but enthusiasm." This enthusiasm extended outside the Jewish community.
To me, it was interesting that something has come out already today, how public celebrations were within the non-Jewish community for Jewish events. And so it was really seen as something to be proud of in view that, of course, as people know, that there was such a beautiful Reform temple that was built. As you see here in the 1930s, it would still be called in the paper, First Jewish Church of the West. But that's meant in a complimentary way, actually. You know, it was looking to say, no, Jews are like us. They've got churches. They just called it something else. And so that you would have a senator speaking very positively about the Jewish community was, I think, really lovely. And also that they would advertise when services were, and people would be open to come and see them.
In 1965, the Orthodox and Reform communities were reunited and began worshiping together at B'nai Israel. No longer served by a full-time rabbi, the congregation relied on long-term resident and businessman Avron Canty to lead services. Avron's son, Dave Canty, describes his father's work on bringing the congregation together.
Dad served as a lead leader of the congregation from that time into the late 70s, early 80s.
Did he have a way of referring to himself? Did he see himself as a chazan, or was there a particular way in which he saw that role, or just as kind of a lay leader?
Just as a lay leader. Very humble man. He would have assumed absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
He would have not assumed the title of rabbi or acting rabbi or anything like that. Just a lay leader who had some knowledge, was able to conduct services for us, teach youngsters for us, and so that's what he did.
Glenn Rayfish recalls Avron Canty teaching him Hebrew.
What I remember is Avron was kind enough to come to my parents' house one night a week, maybe. I'm not 100% sure, but although I sat down at the dining room table and took Hebrew lessons from Avron. So, you know, it was a lot more one-on-one, where, like Sarah was just saying, my daughter, when she learned Hebrew, she learned it once a month on a Saturday morning when the rabbi was here. And then other than that, it was over the phone.
Today, members of the congregation still come together to keep the services, celebrations, and holidays alive. Glenn Rayfish and Paul Blumenthal discuss the contributions of Janet Cornish and others in this role.
Janet Cornish was instrumental in the congregation and teaching Hebrew and keeping the services.
If it wasn't for Dave at the moment, Nancy Oyer, Janet Cornish, still, that's what keeps everything going. You can never thank Dave enough, I don't think, or Janet or Nancy. You know, before that group, you know, it was Pam and Brandy and Janet. And before that, you know, same thing. Like, it was always a joke before. I mean, when the Rudolphs had their store, it was Newton Louie, and then my father and Phil Judd and Avron and all those. They took turns who was president, vice president, secretary, and treasurer. It's like, well, I guess it wasn't really election, you know. All of our parents had so much involvement in it, and, you know, again, we're just trying to, I think, maintain what they did.
This temple served as a place where, at the time, newcomers to Butte, such as Janet Cornish, could become part of the community and were welcomed to the congregation.
While I don't have deep historical roots in Butte, I have felt that to be part of this community has been an honor. I often would say to people in Butte, if you want to see a play, you have to be in one. If you want to have a Jewish community, you have to make one. And so we owe a great deal of debt to the families that came here, the Rayfishes, the Ehrlichs, the Cantys, the Gronfeins, the Rudolphs, the people that made Jay and I feel so welcome here. And the opportunity to help keep things going and to conduct services and to sing at services may help me really connect with my heritage more than any other experience in my life.
In 1989, the congregation began participating in the Student Rabbi Program, which brings seminary students from Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles to congregations in the western states that are not large enough to support a full-time rabbi. Each student typically served for 1 year, visiting the community once a month to lead services, teach religious school, visit congregations in the hospital, and provide spiritual guidance. That program was discontinued in 2007. Currently, the congregation brings a student rabbi to Butte to serve during the High Holy Days. Occasional services are held throughout the year and are led by lay persons and those who are capable of reading from the Torah. The Torah is the Jewish holy book and handwritten in Hebrew on kosher animal parchment. A yad, an ornamental pointer, often in the shape of a hand, is used when reading the Torah, as no one is allowed to touch the parchment. B'nai Israel has four Torahs, which cannot be said for many congregations.
It's unusual, right, in that it has a number of Torahs because of amalgamations of communities and immigrants, so it has... It's sort of per capita Torah ratio is pretty strong.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And we had various families through the years donate.
Additionally, rabbis are brought in to lead life cycle events. The temple was and still is an important part of growing up Jewish in Butte. Glenn Rafish remembers the huge congregation and services on Friday nights and major life events such as his bar mitzvah celebration.
You know, I guess what I really remember is our temple. I always refer to it as the temple or synagogue on Galena Street. So when we grew up, there was to me a huge congregation. I mean, a lot of people. And at that time, Dave's father, Avern, led the Friday night services. And I remember probably grade school, maybe even junior high. You know, we had to go, and we didn't want to go. It was Friday night. When we went to school, there was my brother Brad, 2 years older than me, and then it was the Bronfines. There was Hal, who was my brother's age. But we were the only three Jewish boys in that period in the junior high system and the high school system. So, I mean, it was very unusual. I mean, everything we did was, we were different. You know, we were Jewish and we had no Jewish friends to speak of. All our friends were of other religions, so they're always very interested in what we did or what was going on. I remember, like, when we had our bar mitzvah, you know, we were able to invite our friends, kind of like a big birthday party. And again, it was an unusual event because our friends had no idea what this was or what it, you know, it was a big deal. We had a rabbi come in to do the bar mitzvah at the temple. All of our family that came in from, you know, different states. It was a life, you know, event. And mine at that time in 74, I guess, or whatever, receptionist was, I think, at the War Bonnet Inn after, which you kind of refer to as a wedding reception. You know, it was a very, you know, big deal, so.
Other members of the congregation had their bar mitzvah celebrations as adults, as told by Janet Cornish.
Like Linda, I didn't have a bat mitzvah at age 12. Girls have it at 12, while boys have it at 13. But I did, when I was 44 years old, have a bat mitzvah, a b'nai mitzvah also, with Louise Ziegler and Pam Rudolph, and we shared that day together. Getting to read from the Torah, which is all in Hebrew, and without vowels, so you have to really practice a lot, memorize a lot. And just that experience of being part of a community and being able to connect through music was particularly important to me.
Temple B'nai Israel is the only remaining synagogue of three that originally served Butte's Jewish community. Though not the first synagogue built in Montana, Temple B'nai Israel has the distinction of being its continuous use for the longest period of time of any congregation in the state. It is also the only synagogue in the state originally built for that specific purpose still in use today. Although numbers are dwindling, the members of the congregation continue to carefully maintain the beautiful building with its distinctive onion dome and bright red brick exterior. In 2003, restoration work was completed at the temple. Paul Blumenthal, president of the B'nai Israel Board at the time, discusses the work, the restoration work, and the completion of the temple in 2003.
The board of the B'nai Israel, I was the president of the board for a couple of years, and it was during the renovation, and we did an RFP with some architects, and we chose an architect, Lyle Matthews and Associates, to renovate the temple, and it was painted inside and out, re-roofed, copper flashing installed, protection for all the stained glass windows. The contractor was Bentley, and you can They did a great job, all of them. And I just happened to be the president of the board at the time, and I'm an architect and a project manager, so it was... And Walter Hittig Jr. took pictures of the building, I know that, and it was in the paper. That was in 2003, I think.
In 1936, Butte was host to the 73rd Annual Convention of District 4 of the B'nai B'rith and the 14th Annual Convention of the Women's Grand Lodge, with Mayor Charles Halsworth welcoming delegates to the city. Convention headquarters was located at the Finland Hotel. There was a dinner for guests in Meaderville at both the Rocky Mountain Cafe and the Golden Fan. There was also a luncheon and entertainment at the temple and a banquet at the Columbia Gardens. The host lodge was the Baron de Hirsch Lodge of Butte, with delegates including William Mayer, Harry Mayer, M.H. Schwartz, I. Simon, Joseph Bernard. Elections were held for officers for the next year, as well as choosing the convention location for 1937. First Vice President Mrs. Goldie Spire and Second Vice President Miss Celia Lessman of the Women's Grand Lodge presided over the women's meetings. The convention was a success, with Mrs. Bessie Schwab, retiring president of the Women's Grand Lodge, noting that never has she seen such hospitality, and the spirit of Butte's people captivated her. Butte's early Jewish settlers came to America as children or young men, the sons of merchants and entrepreneurs, in search of economic opportunities and religious freedoms. Once in America, the lure of the West and the mining boom in California brought them eventually to Montana. Their entrepreneurial spirit was the perfect match for the New West. They perfected their trade in Europe and the large eastern cities of America, becoming tradesmen, tailors, pawnbrokers, and peddlers.
Junk peddler was a massive Jewish profession. It actually inspired then a lot of Jewish artists. So even people like Philip Guston, who I wrote about in my first book, he was really inspired by his father being a junk peddler. It shows up in a lot of his paintings. He and Philip Roth, when they lived together in Woodstock in the 1960s, would go to the dump together and go and fish out things. Like, so there was, and they would talk about how they were reliving their Jewish past together. So this history of, you know, being peddlers and these things, and that was what essentially what my grandfather was in many ways, selling, you know, blue jeans out of the back of the truck kind of thing, is that that was a point of entry into a very quick movement through into other professions and into merchandising and wholesaling things, and then making savvy investments sometimes in the mines and other things like that. So it's interesting how much a lot of these things would have changed quickly in some cases, and you can see things like, you know, I like this one, waiter, gambler. You know, it's hard to know, is it gambler, waiter, waiter, gambler? So I get the tip, then I do, yeah. So we see some, you know, things that begin to crop up in that way.
The need for miners for equipment and supplies drove many Jewish merchants into the mercantile and pawnbroking businesses, establishing themselves in Bannock, Virginia City, Helena, Deer Lodge, and finally in Butte. Pawnbrokers often evolved into jewelers or investment firms. Tailors began to sell clothing, particularly to men. And dry goods and furniture stores were also run by Jewish merchants. Owning a permanent storefronted business made these early Jewish settlers some of the city's first permanent residents, who ultimately built businesses, homes, and temples in the new territory of Montana. Many became successful merchants and community members in Butte, opening mercantile shops such as Sands and Boyce and Goldsmith and Company. Butte's pioneering Jews supplied the city with goods and services. David Cohen sold tobacco and cigars. H.L. Frank sold wholesale liquor. Henry Jacobs and others sold men's clothing. The Oppenheimers were the wholesale produce business. The first wave of Jewish immigrants to the city were predominantly of German descent, and almost all were merchants. In 1885, nearly a quarter of Butte's mercantile stores selling clothing, jewelry, hats, cigars, hardware, furniture, and food were Jewish-owned. By the early 20th century, there were several large furniture or department stores owned by Jewish merchants by the names of Simons, Shiner, Rosenberg, Finberg, Judd, Canty, Rudolph, Rayfish, Browdy, Weinberg, Katz, Cohen, Moran's, Gordon, Brinning, and Mayer. Philip Levy became a local theater impresario, collecting ownership of the Ansonia, Orpheum, Princess, and Broadway theaters, in addition to others in the Northwest. Simon's Dry Good was established in 1897 and became one of the largest department stores in Butte. It was because of this success that many Jewish families would become part of the prominent, wealthy class of Butte. Although Jewish residents in Butte lived throughout the city, many lived near their businesses and religious centers. As businesses were established on East and West Park Street, the Jewish settled in areas centered on the business district and near their temple in South Butte. The South Butte neighborhood had a kosher butcher and Jewish specialty store on Main Street. The Knoffels made a kosher kitchen in the Spokane restaurant. As the Jewish businesses thrived, the business owners moved to the west side, many building lovely mansions like the Simons House at 3 North Excelsior Street. Glenn Rafish remembers the density of Jewish businesses within the vicinity of Park and Main Streets and the community and faith that stemmed from that.
When I was growing up, going to my dad's shoe store as a kid, that whole block, I remember Phil Judd's Sporting Goods store, which was a Jewish merchant, Shiner's Furniture, Jewish merchant, Rudolph's Furniture, Jewish merchant. There was Finberg's across the street, Jewish merchant. There was our store. Dave's father had his grand clothes up on Main Street, Montana Street. There was Rosenberg's furniture store in town, Finberg's across the street. So a lot of Jewish merchants, as we got older, and again, I'm all over the board here, but I remember when we would need a minion to do for someone after their passing for going to the temple
for your side.
Right.
To memorialize the person who passed.
Right. All we would do is call up the other stores and can we all meet at 5:30 at the temple. And all the stores were uptown. Out of the merchants, you'd get them and we'd all go meet at the temple for a 20-minute service right before we go home for dinner.
When I was a youngster growing up, if somebody needed a minion to say Kaddish, and that is a memorial prayer for the deceased, so if your father or your grandfather or your mother or your grandmother or whoever had passed and it was the anniversary of their death, you would want to say the Kaddish, which is the basic memorial prayer of remembrance in Judaism. If you needed a minion to say Kaddish, all you had to do was walk down Park Street for 5 minutes.
Wow.
You stepped into each door and said, hey, I need a minion at 5:30 when you close the store. Done.
Relationships were also formed from this tight-knit community. Linda Bookie shares this story about her mother and her father and how they met because of Ray Fish's dentistry business.
My father, Jack Bookie, came out here after World War II, where he served in the Army and occupation forces. He came out he was on the GI Bill going to Rolla School of Mines, and he came out to Missouri School of Mines, yes, in Rolla. He came out to work in the mines. Met my mom that first summer he was here because he was interning first week at work in one of the mines. He made some rookie error and ended up in the hospital with an injury. And the day he got discharged, he was walking past the Metals Bank building and he looked up and he saw the sign, Samuel Rafish Dentist. And he thought, oh, I've had this tooth bothering me forever. I will go get my tooth fixed while I'm off work. My mom was working there. She had just graduated high school. And they went out a little bit that summer. She was not very impressed by him. He really liked my grandparents, and they kind of adopted him. So they both went back to colleges. My mom graduated from UCLA, but every summer my parents met and my father ended up working for Anaconda and was adopted by my grandparents, I think, even before they were engaged.
Some of Butte's earliest pioneers came as Jewish immigrants. Henry Jacobs was born in Baden, Germany in 1835. Jacobs was a Confederate soldier during the Civil War and came to Montana in 1866. He was among the earliest of Butte's Jewish residents, moving to Butte in 1876 and erecting Butte's first brick home at the corner of Granite and Montana Streets, still known as the Jacobs House today. Henry Jacobs was elected Butte's first mayor and served one term from 1879 to 1880. Jacobs served as a school trustee for 3 years and served as the president of the Hebrew Benevolent Association, which had been organized in the late 1880s. Jacobs ran mercantiles called Jacobs & Company and sold clothing to the people of Butte. Jacobs and his wife, Adele, had 6 children. He died in 1887 and is buried in the B'nai Israel Cemetery. Henry Lubin Frank, also known as H.L. Frank, was elected as Butte's second Jewish mayor in 1885. He was a member of the Montana State Legislature from 1889 to 1891. Prior to being elected mayor, Frank was a wholesale liquor distributor, opened the Montana Liquor Company, and became a wealthy mine speculator. Frank served as president of both the Butte Water Company and the Butte Silver Bow Electric Company. Well-known Jewish American author Myron Brinning was born in 1896, the son of Moses and Rebecca Brinning. Moses Brinning was born Moses Flegelman in Romania. He eventually left Romania after the imposition of mandatory conscription during the Balkan War and changed his name to the Dutch interpretation of Flegelman, Brining. He arrived in America in 1887 and worked as a peddler sent for his family. Moses has cousins in Helena who convinced him and Rebecca to leave Minnesota. Moses and Rebecca arrived in Montana in 1900, and Moses opened a men's furnishing store called the OK Store. The store sold miners' boots, slickers, overalls, which were sold at a bargain rate. Moses drafted his young sons into the business, and young Myron was tasked with watching for thieves who may walk away from the outdoor racks. Myron loved the street activity on Saturday nights, as well as the theater and movies which fed his imagination. The Brinings' experience as Orthodox Jews conflicted with the newly found city of Butte, where Saturday, the day of the Sabbath, was the best business day. They had trouble meshing their religion with their business and personal financial needs, which is a common story of the Jewish narrative in the bustling mining town of Butte, Montana. George Simons was a pioneer businessman and one of the founders of Simons Dry Goods Company. George was born in New York in 1850 and came to Butte around 1890, where he became associated in business with J.E. Oppenheimer, his brother-in-law. George oversaw the cigar manufacturing business and became known in particularly every state in the West, where he promoted the sale of Baltimore cigars, later being known as Baltimore George. Simons was a loyal member of the Butte Joshers Club, which helped Butte families in need. George remained in Butte until 1924, when he moved to Los Angeles. He died in 1930. Kalman Rudolph came to Butte in 1914 as a Russian immigrant. Rudolph opened his first furniture store in Butte in 1921 and was later associated with his sons in Standard Furniture, later known as Rudolph's Furniture. The store was originally located at 215 East Park Street, then at 105 East Park Street, and in 1939 moved to its present-day location at 65 East Park Street. In the 1940s, Kalman's children, Lou and Newt, took over the businesses, but Kalman spent partial days in the store until he was 90 years old. In the late 1990s, Lou turned the business over to his son, Mike Rudolph. Kalman was a member of the B'nai B'rith for more than 50 years, was a member of the B'nai Israel congregation, and the Butte Pioneers Club. Kalman would still help at the store until his death in 1979. Butte's Jewish people have made their mark on the city through their traditions, business, and buildings that few other places in the West can claim. Mary McCormick, Historic Preservation Officer for Butte Silver Bow, has this to say about the Jewish impact in Butte.
I always think it's interesting that Carson Becker always talked about the trifecta, and I know, you know, maybe that, I mean, the Jacob House to me is just so, I mean, that's, you know, the oldest house in Butte, and it's Butte's first mayor, and it's...
What do you mean by the trifecta?
The trifecta, the Jacob's House, the temple, and the cemetery.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that, and trying to preserve and make, I mean, certainly the temple is the premier resource, Jewish resource in town, and there is no other place in Montana like that, and it's so important. But that whole, you know, this whole concept of, you know, that we have this great house, that we have the temple, and we have the Jewish cemetery here in Butte, I think is just so incredible. And